Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Young climate activists from around the world are demanding real action at COP26 in Glasgow this week. Here is Brianna Fruin, a 23-year-old climate activist from Samoa, addressing world leaders on Monday.
I don't need to remind you the reality of vulnerable communities. If you're here today, you know what climate change is doing to us. You don't need my pain or my tears to know that we're in a crisis. The real question is whether you have the political will to do the right thing, to wield the right words, and to follow it up with long overdue action. If you're looking for inspiration on this, look no further than the climate leadership of young Pacific people. We are not just victims to this crisis. We have been resilient beacons of hope. Pacific youth have rallied behind the cry, "We are not drowning, we are fighting." This is our warrior cry to the world. We are not drowning, we are fighting. This is my message from Earth to COP. I hope you remember my words today and look closely at your words as you go throughout COP, because e pala ma'a aile pala upu. Thank you.
That was Brianna Fruin, a 23-year-old climate activist from Samoa, addressing world leaders at COP26 on Monday. Almost every young person on Earth is exposed to at least one climate and environmental hazard, such as heat waves, cyclones, air pollution, flooding, or water scarcity. This is according to a new report by UNICEF. Approximately 1 billion children live in 33 countries classified in their index as extremely high risk. Children from countries that contribute the least to climate change suffer the greatest consequences. The 33 extremely high risk countries collectively emit only 9% of CO2 emissions. The 10 highest countries collectively emit only 0.5% of global emissions. Environmental advocates have called out COP26 for a lack of diversity, accessibility, and inclusion, especially voices of indigenous groups and representatives of the global south. Joining us from Glasgow is Julieta Rodrigo, a certified climate science educator and a member of Climate Generation's Window into COP26 delegation. Julieta is a program manager at the Clio Institute. That's a nonprofit that works to empower communities in Florida to demand climate action, ensuring a safe, just, and healthy environment. Julieta educates students, teachers, and the general public about the climate crisis. In a piece for Climate Generation, Julieta writes, "As a result of vaccine apartheid, visa delays, and exorbitant costs for housing and travel to Glasgow, COP26 is missing many voices that represent the most vulnerable in the climate crisis." Hi, Julieta. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you. So can you just explain to us, how do you end up at Glasgow as a young person? How do you get access to this massive conference?
Some people are invited and some apply. So in order to get access to the Conference of Parties under an accredited badge, you need to be part of a delegation with a registered organization that's part of the United Nations accredited list. I was offered a spot on the delegation with Climate Generation, a Will Steger legacy. They're a climate organization based in Minnesota, and they take delegates to COP every year. They've been doing it for several years, and they had badges available to share with people who are working on education and civic engagement. So there was a call out where you could apply for these badges. And so we went through an interview process after I submitted an essay, and they offered me the spot. So I'm here with the Climate Generation delegation.
So tell us about your experience, because in the piece that you wrote for Climate Justice, you wrote that so many voices are missing that represent the most vulnerable in the climate crisis. And a lot of articles, especially in The Guardian, have been written about this. Ita Mendoza, a 46-year-old indigenous land defender from Oaxaca, who's part of a collective, Futuros Indigenas, is a COP first timer and spent months crowdfunding just to be able to attend COP so their community's struggles and visions for protecting the planet would be heard. And Mendoza said, COP is big business. It's a continuation of colonialism where people come not to listen to us, but to make money from our land and our natural resources. So what are you experiencing, Julieta? It seems like some people have made it, but a lot of people are, you know, commenting that there have been so many barriers to ensure that people who are hit the hardest are there expressing their views.
Right. There have been so many layers of complications, especially due to the COVID-19 pandemic. And we are still in the midst of this pandemic. And COP26 was delayed for a year to make time to accommodate this conference. There are so many voices that are not here. I mentioned in the article, vaccine apartheid. The United Nations promised that they would send vaccines to interested delegates in order to gain access to the United Kingdom. That wasn't fully completed. In addition, when delegates were trying to find housing, either in Edinburgh or Glasgow, they faced exorbitant housing prices. There was price gouging everywhere, and there was an effort to crowdsource homestays where local Glaswegians opened up their homes to house some delegates. But the demand for housing was so much stronger and bigger than the supply that Glaswegians were able to provide. So that was that issue. We also had issues with visa delays because many delegates were waiting on the vaccines from the United Nations, and that would have impacted the way that they applied for their visas. It impacted their ability to even get into the country. Once you were able to get into the country, there were also complications in terms of quarantine. Any delegate from a red list country had to do a mandatory quarantine. Initially, the costs were going to be a burden on the delegates. Then the United Nations COP organizers announced that they would be covering the cost. But even then, delegates had to come 5 or 10 days earlier, depending on the nation, to Glasgow and spend additional money just to be able to access the space. Once we are in the space, we see more layers of complications. For instance, there are way more men than women in this COP, and that's going to cause differences in the kinds of conversations that are taking place. There are 9,000 men and only 4,000 women at the COP right now. There are also countries that are being disproportionately represented and underrepresented. There are entire countries that don't even have a single representative at COP, while other countries have more than 700 representatives. Wow. And so what does that mean for a climate conference where we're negotiating really delicate topics about justice and representation if not everybody is here?
Well, let's hear from a clip about this. This is young climate activist Aisha Sadiqa, co-founder of Polluters Out Now, telling Now This that COP26 is not accessible.
We went through so much trouble to get this little piece of paper right here with, you know, our names on it so that we could go inside of the blue zone. And we are just sitting in the common areas because we are not allowed into the decision-making spaces. We are not allowed because you have to get tickets to go in. And people who get tickets are people who have connections and people who didn't have to fight to come here.
Every stage, the word youth is coming out of people's mouths left and right. Like, they've used us to a point where it's like, ridiculous, but none of us are invited. I think it's criminal how much Airbnbs, hotels are charging for people to lodge here. Flight prices have gone up the roof. Food here is ridiculously expensive, and that's just from the financial aspect. There was train strikes for weeks at an end. Taxi cabs are probably the only form of transportation. And then the venue itself. For disabled folk, it is absolutely inaccessible. They have revolving doors. You can't get in with a wheelchair.
A lot of people maybe can't participate on both days, but do the effort to come out and just share the space with people. You know, we have to show governments that we are still coming out, that we're still protesting. And not one protest is going to change the world, but looking at history, consistency is what changes the world. You know, mass demonstrations is what changes the world. And it shouldn't be like that, but it is what sways governments and politicians to realize that people are willing to show up.
That is young climate activist Ayesha Siddiqua, co-founder of Polluters Out, telling Now This that COP26 is not accessible. Today, we are joined by Julieta Rodrigo, a certified climate science educator and member of Climate Generation's Window into COP26 delegation. Julieta is also a program manager at the Clio Institute. They work to empower communities in Florida to demand climate action, ensuring a safe, just, and healthy environment. Julieta will be with us for about 15 or so more minutes. So if you want to ask her any questions about what actually goes on at COP26, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, or also just the work that she does to really educate people about the climate crisis. And if you have any overall comments about COP26, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Julieta, the Pacific Islands activists there are so strong on so many levels. But according to Island Innovation, a third of Pacific Islands have announced that they were unable to send delegations for the first time in COP history. And yet they are the most impacted. So what are you hearing at COP26 about what's going on with activists from the Pacific Islands?
We're hearing a lot of the same issues. There was a report from carbonbrief.org this morning about who is here at COP and who is not here. And COVID-19 travel restrictions have severely impacted their ability to travel to COP. There are many issues as to why, but among them is the fear of taking COVID-19 back to their islands, many of which have remained COVID-free. We also have the issue of exorbitant costs. Like I was mentioning, it's simply not feasible to accommodate delegates with these exorbitant costs of getting to Glasgow, of staying in Glasgow, of quarantining, of vaccines and visa applications. There are so many layers that complicate their presence.
So what is it like at COP26, given what you just laid out, that wealthy countries have a lot of delegates there and countries that are hit the hardest do not? I mean, are you able to go to various sessions? Are protesters inside voicing their views? I mean, can you just give us a sense of what actually happens in the halls?
Absolutely. COP26, the official venue is called the Blue Zone. The Blue Zone is where party negotiations take place. That's where you have the plenary sessions, where you see the big rooms where presidents speak, where prime ministers speak, where the COP president gave a speech. We haven't been granted access to the plenary sessions. Like that audio clip you included a few minutes ago, there is a ticketing system. And for the first 2 days of the conference, 18 delegates were allowed in out of the 30,000 of us that traveled to Glasgow to be a part of this conference. So if you talk about 18 out of 30,000, not only did it cause a lot of confusion, but it also caused a lot of chaos of just, who was in charge of making those decisions, and how do we get access? Is there some sort of rotating system? How do we increase access? You also talk about the conference size itself. It's located inside a convention center. It's called the Scottish Event Campus, and there are different rooms, like a typical convention center, where you can go in and see panels, or you can see talks being given by professors or researchers. There are also pavilions being hosted by different countries. And it sounds so great. And I was so excited to learn from so many people. And what happens is more restricted access. I went to a session yesterday on storytelling. I could not even enter the room because they had reached capacity. And I was told to go into the hallway and to join on my computer. That's not acceptable, because we flew all the way out here and we're being told to live stream the event just like everybody else is doing, that isn't even at the COP. When you talk about the room size themselves, the biggest room, I think, has a capacity of under 150 people. And while I understand that there are COVID restrictions and they're trying to accommodate social distancing, more thought should have been given to the fact that we have thousands of people here. And if you have 140 seats, that's not going to accommodate the diversity that is needed to have really fruitful negotiations. We've been denied access again and again, and really confusing instructions as to who is being granted access. We get emails from the United Nations COP organizers saying, you know, we appreciate your patience and we're sorry for the inconvenience, but it's a really thinly veiled excuse and apology. And organizers inside are using social media to raise their concerns because we can't get inside the rooms. And that's a tremendous shame.
What is actually being discussed, Julieta? Because, you know, years ago, Indigenous activists, for example, at Standing Rock, said, leave it in the ground. And that has now become a rallying cry for activists around the globe, that fossil fuel projects need to end and that fossil fuel subsidies need to end. Are those two things being even discussed in the halls of power and at these events inside COP26?
From the official negotiations, I can't even tell you that much because I don't have access to them. There is such a lack of transparency in what is happening in those rooms. What I can tell you is what's being discussed in the informal sessions led by civil society, or when you run into activists and organizations in the hallways. There are certain goals of COP26. Among them is finishing something called the Paris Rulebook. We passed the Paris Agreement in 2015, but the rulebook to measure implementation and progress and to make sure that each country is doing what they said that they were going to do in their contributions, that hasn't even been defined. We are also working on achieving $100 billion in funding for developing nations to transition to renewable energy. That was something that was set years ago, and countries still have not been able to provide the $100 billion that are needed every year to help in this transition. And the United States is among that list of countries that pledged to be a part of that. We also have a complicated mechanism called carbon markets, which is part of the Paris Rulebook, where countries are negotiating really small but important details as to what counts as a carbon credit. What does it mean to do net zero with carbon offsets? And how do you make sure that that's transparent and fair and true to form? So that's what's being discussed officially. Unofficially, there are a lot of conversations about justice happening in the hallways.
What's happening on the streets? There are so many protests taking place outside COP26.
Yes. COP26 has a layer of security mechanisms in order to get access to the venue. There are about 4 different security checkpoints. Think of it like an airport, in which your badge is checked, your lateral flow test is checked, your passport is checked, your bags are checked. All of that happens after the gate. On the other side of the gate are where the demonstrations are. I've been seeing a lot of them, mostly in the afternoon, but some that were happening during the World Leaders Summit, when the world leaders were giving their speeches. The protesters are calling out greenwashing and fake promises and empty promises. There were a lot of signs about dictatorships and how they're not taking care of their citizens and that they're putting their residents in jeopardy with their lack of action on human rights and climate. So that happens often. And tomorrow there is going to be a big march led by Fridays for Future as part of their marches that happen every Friday. And then Saturday there is an even bigger march. They're expecting between 50,000 and 100,000 people to attend through the city center. So that's another way for youth to get involved.
Julieta, before we let you go, I want to ask you about the work that you do with the Clio Institute. Again, this is a nonprofit that empowers communities in Florida to demand climate action. You also educate students, teachers, and the public about the climate crisis. You all go into schools and talk to young people about the climate crisis. And there have been a couple of stories recently, some interesting ones in ABC News and Politico, about how misinformation and conspiracy theories are really hitting a quote, an alarming number of Latino voters in Florida through Spanish language social media sites, advocacy groups, right-wing radio. And I just wonder, can you give us some insights about what kind of misinformation and lies are being told through Spanish language media about the climate crisis? And how are you all trying to counter that?
Whew, this is definitely a multi-layered question. So I'll start from the beginning. My work with the Clio Institute is to educate students and teachers. And what's really great is that there was so much overlap between the Clio Institute and Climate Generation that when I was invited to be a part of their delegation, it was a natural fit because I already worked on the ACE framework, which is to drive forth civic participation of all ages, but especially youth. Now, when we talk about conspiracy theories, there is a science teacher in the team called Carolyn. And Carolyn taught me something very important about the use of language. Conspiracy theories are an oxymoron in many ways, because a theory is a well-substantiated explanation of something happening in the natural world, and it incorporates laws and hypotheses and facts, and conspiracy theories don't. They're based on flawed logic. So when we use the term conspiracy theory, we're also giving a term of legitimacy, because students take the idea that, well, this is a theory. How is it different from other theories that I'm learning in science, like the theory of relativity, gravity? Are they on the same scope? Students are facing a lot of misinformation, and a lot of that is because of really successful campaigns from fossil fuel companies. For example, when we go into schools and we interact with students and teachers about climate solutions and what can we do on campus to make it more green and to make it more resilient, almost without fail, the first responses are, we should increase and expand our recycling program, and we should do beach cleanups. Because I live in Miami, Florida, and you know the beach is a place that's very much valued and beloved. And that is not the climate solution that we need. It's not even among the list of climate solutions that we need. The recycling programs, at least in Florida, are so inefficient. And in many parts of the country, it's the same thing. What we try to do with students and with teachers is to expand their ability to connect the dots on solutions and to bring in the lens of social justice. For instance, when we go into schools, we bring in topics of air pollution and how it disproportionately impacts communities of color. We talk about indigenous land rights. We talk about the fact that agricultural workers and construction workers are disproportionately impacted by extreme heat. We talk about the access to public transit and tree canopies. That causes more depth to the climate conversation, and we start seeing students be more able to connect the dots. We're battling decades of misinformation from fossil fuel companies saying the responsibility is on people to save the climate. The idea of a carbon footprint was created and marketed by the BP Oil Institute. And that put the blame on people, because if your carbon footprint was too high, you're the reason why we're in a climate crisis. And it's definitely not BP's fault. It's your fault. We're trying to change that narrative and say that, yes, individual solutions are important. We'd love to see more people incorporate more plants into their diet, reducing their food waste at home and in their schools. But we also need to change the system in which we're operating in, because the blame has been put on individuals for far too long, and corporations have been able to shift that blame successfully onto us and not take responsibility for their tremendous and gigantic role in this issue. Most of the carbon emissions that we're seeing come from just 100 corporations. And so if we can put pressure on them to do better, that's going to take us a long way in fixing this climate problem.
Wow. Well, Julieta, I would love to have you back with maybe a couple other educators to really talk more about the amazing work you're doing in schools, because this really needs to get out. And I'm sure we've got a lot of teachers and parents who listen to the show, and I'm sure that they would love to have programs like this in their schools if something similar isn't there already. So huge thanks to you and everyone at Clio for your great work. We'd love to have you back. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Have a great afternoon.
Thank you. You too. Julieta Rodrigo is a certified climate science educator joining us from Glasgow at COP26. She's a program manager at the Clio Institute. This is a nonprofit that works to empower communities in Florida. And as she was just explaining, she and others educate students, teachers, and the general public about the climate crisis. So important. We will definitely do an entire show around this education. Well, now we are going to get an update on the five young climate activists from across the country who started a hunger strike in Washington, D.C. on October 20th. You remember that about 2 weeks ago, we were joined by Emma Govia, a young climate activist from Santa Rosa, California, and we tried to reconnect with her, but as time went on, these young people were just so incredibly tired because they were only drinking water, and then politicians would come by. So things were a bit hectic. But they decided to end their hunger strike on Tuesday. They are going to continue the fight. They just had an action to pressure Senate Democrats, especially Joe Manchin, Senator Joe Manchin, to act on the climate crisis. And we are now joined again by Emma Govia, a young climate activist from Santa Rosa, California. Hi, Emma. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So what was the experience like? Again, you all went on a hunger strike on October 20th, and you just ended on Tuesday.
Absolutely. The experience of going on a hunger strike was very difficult. It was very hard. It was very detrimenting to our bodies and our mental health. And like I said, we just ended our hunger strike to demand that Biden and leaders like Joe Manchin keep their promises on climate.
Emma, for those who did not hear you when you were on our show a couple weeks ago, can you again remind us, why did you decide to go on a hunger strike?
Yeah, we decided to go on a hunger strike because we've been working on this bill for a very long time, and the work that our movement had put in is super important. And we realized that we got a call that Joe Manchin was threatening to not vote for this bill. He was going to potentially stop this bill that has a lot of climate and other provisions in it from passing. And so we decided to make the choice to do this very high sacrifice action because our leaders were not being leaders and folding to Joe Manchin and his fossil fuel money.
Now you're 18, right? You're a high school senior?
Yeah, I'm 18.
Can you just tell us how you got involved in climate activism?
Absolutely. I got involved in the climate movement when I learned about climate change, and then I realized over time that the adults in the room, the politicians, were not treating it like the crisis that it is, and they were not passing the legislation necessary. And so I realized that I needed to step up and organize around this to protect my own future and the future of all those that I love.
And we were just talking with Julieta Rodrigo about the great education that she and the Clio Institute do in Florida, where they talk to young people about what we're facing. So you're a high school student in Santa Rosa. Is this something that is taught or discussed in your school?
Absolutely. So I go to a pretty small school, and we do learn a bit about climate change. However, it is from organizing and school walkouts that myself and my friends have organized that we've really taught each other about the climate movement and also our power as young people to stand up to politicians and fossil fuel CEOs in this way and actually make change in that way.
What has this hunger strike taught you about how the system works? Because you did have some progressive congresspeople come out to talk with you. In fact, the day you were supposed to be on, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib came out, and so you weren't able to join us. But given the interactions with the politicians, the media coverage that you did or did not get, what is this really, what kind of insights have you gained as a result of this experience?
Absolutely. From this, we've learned that young people, when we do take these seemingly like really crazy and high sacrifice measures, that it does have an impact. And we protected a lot of the climate provisions in this bill. However, it did show us that in our current system, that senators like Joe Manchin do have the ability to really halt this legislation and keep us from getting the life-saving legislation that we need. But we also know that this is a very long fight, and we as a country do need to get fossil fuel money out of our political system.
What are the most important provisions to you in the Democrat social spending and climate bill?
Yeah, so this bill has and when it was proposed, it had very historic and amazing climate legislation in it. But this, of course, we know is not just a climate bill, and also has had in it many life-saving and vitally important things for normal working class Americans, such as, for me in particular, free community college and pathways to citizenship. Funding for education and paid family leave, and all of those are very important and interconnected. And we also, those are very important things for all of our country and myself.
What about, just quickly before we let you go, the Civilian Climate Corps, which would put hundreds of thousands of young people to work to transform the U.S. energy system and also to work to protect frontline Absolutely. Communities?
Absolutely. The Civilian Climate Corps is something that, I said before on your show that many of us actually participated in and organized these marches across the country, from New Orleans to Houston and across California, in support of the Civilian Climate Corps. And this is the Civilian Climate Corps in this bill would provide many thousands of jobs to young people like myself, and especially those in frontline communities, to protect the places that they love and avert the worst of the crisis.
Well, before we let you go, Emma, you all have been in solidarity with the New York City cab drivers who recently ended their hunger strike after a major victory. And
Absolutely.
We are going to be joined by Augustine Tang in just a minute. So do you have any message you'd
Incredible.
Like to send Augustine, who's now listening, as we end
Absolutely.
The interview with you?
Just that we on our hunger strike are so incredibly happy. When we learned about your win, we were just overjoyed and ecstatic. And yeah, we are very encouraged and happy for you all, and definitely stand in very strong solidarity. It made us all very, very happy. Yes.
Well, Emma, thank you so much for your great work, and thank you for joining us. We'd love to have you back.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That is Emma Govia, an 18-year-old high school senior young climate activist from Santa Rosa, California, who started a hunger strike in front of the White House on October 20th with four others. They ended their strike on Tuesday with a vow to keep up the fight. Coming up after a quick break, we will talk about the historic New York City cab driver medallion debt bailout victory after a 15-day hunger strike. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.